Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you. Welcome to Real Recovery. It's Bill and George. We're awfully glad that we have this time once again to have a story of transformation of what God's doing in the life of not only one, but two people tonight. So we're looking forward to having our guest, Ben, and his wife, Sarah, on the program in just a minute. George, as always, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks, Bill. Welcome to you, too.
Yeah, thank you. You know, community is so critical in recovery, and I think that's going to be part of the story tonight.
Community.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Do you know
it is? It's important.
Yeah.
Community. You know, it's very important.
It feels like you're making fun of me, which
I am.
I enjoy that. Okay.
George, you're good at that.
Do you know about the Rat Park? The Rat Park. There was a researcher by Bruce Alexander, Dr. Bruce Alexander. He was understanding that addiction is far more than just any drug, because he did this experiment in the 1970s where he placed a rat alone in a cage with no other community of rats and offered two water bottles, one filled with water and the other one with heroin or cocaine. And the rats would repetitively drink from the drug-laced bottles until they all overdosed and died. That was it. And then he was wondering, is it about the drug or is it related to something else? So to test his hypothesis, he put the rats in a rat park where they were, among others, free to roam and play and to socialize. And they were given the same access to the same two types of drug-laced bottles. When inhabiting a rat park, they remarkably just preferred the plain water. They would imbibe occasionally on the drug-filled bottle, but they did so intermittently, not obsessively, and none of the rats overdosed because a social community beat the power of drugs.
Interesting.
Yeah, so I should have run that by you in advance.
No, maybe we should all head out to the park today. But I agree, you don't stay sober without a community. You might, you know, achieve abstinence for a while, but we need other people to be around, to be accountable to have people tell us no, and actually have a good time with.
Right.
And I think, Bill, most of the people we work with are kind of rats, too. I know I am. If it's not working, I'm going to go back to what worked before for a while.
Yeah.
Because that's better than nothing. And when we work with people who get sober, which is abstinent, which with a change in your lifestyle, there's always a community involved of others. We've talked about on the show, addiction is isolation. Recovery involves community. So does church. But I need to be around people that have struggled with the same issues that I do, because, you know, those aren't on the back burner. They come up still, and in a way that we relate to others, the way we relate to God, the way we walk it out. And it's very interesting that you'd bring this up today. I've been dealing with the COVID. It's not the 19 anymore, Bill. What is it? COVID-23?
Probably.
And it got me out of my non-negotiable routine of working out, meeting with other guys. And technology's help with Zoom and reaching out on the phone. But boy, I'll tell you, there wasn't a lot of joy the last 10 days, and glad to be back working my recovery walk the way I used to.
Yeah, because for as long as I've known you, your community has always been very critical to your well-being. And you've got your groups that you go to, your church you go to. You've got your people that you see at the gym all the time. You've got your 12-step meeting groups and your golfing buddies, and all of that contributes to keeping George F. Nice and well balanced.
Out of prison, safer for society. That's the way I look at it. And no doubt, Bill, what you were going to say next is I would be a lot farther along if I had better friends. And I couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, thank you.
I can't take any responsibility for this myself. But isn't that the truth in all walks?
Yes.
We're just not meant to be alone.
Right. Yeah, no, that's so true. So we've only got 3 minutes left. Let's jump on a step, and that's your department. So which step would you like to talk about briefly?
Well, what I was going to talk about tonight real quickly in the 3 minutes that we have for this bill is that we usually talk about one step a week, but I found myself the last week working a lot of them. Step one is we admitted we were powerless over drugs and alcohol. Our life was unmanageable. I admit that, and to accept that, I need to go to two, where I come to believe that a power greater than me could restore me to sanity. Sanity be living and acting in the truth. And three, turning my will and my life over to the care of Jesus as I understand him. And to get to that and realizing that I am limited by how I can walk that out, I need to go to 12, where I practice these principles in all my affairs. And the first one for me, principle, is honesty. I don't like this. I want to change this. Openness. Okay, what can I do? I'm a recovering alcoholic, cocaine addict, and I'm not able to walk out my normal walk with God and with others due to an illness. And willingness. It's H-O-W, honesty, openness, willingness. My willingness is to get on the phone, to pray to God. And, you know, I've acknowledged that I'm struggling. I can't do what I normally do. But if you seek God out, he'll make it so it's good enough. You know, you're not tempted beyond what you can handle. But I had to work this week a little harder than I was used to. But God is there and so are other people. And I think, you know, you just have to go, hey, I'm hurting a little bit. Can you help me?
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's something I wouldn't have done 40 years ago because I got it. Well, I never had anything. And I remember my dad said, when George says he's got it, the opposite is going to prove to be true. And that was.
Mm-hmm. All right. We're going to have a great story tonight. I'm looking forward to it. Our guest is Ben. His wife, Sarah, is here with us tonight. So we just want to thank you, too. This week, we had our amazing one-day winter fundraiser. And I just want to say thanks to everyone who gave so generously and care about the show and care about the station. And just thank you very, very much. We're going to take a break, and then we'll be right back with our show tonight. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. We'll be right back. Back to Real Recovery. George, like I mentioned in the first segment, I love small world stories, and tonight's one of those occasions where we get to connect to people that we already know, and we didn't know we knew, but here they are, and they're going to tell an amazing story. Ben and Sarah, welcome to the program.
Yeah, glad to be here.
Yeah. Now, I don't know, Sarah, how much you're going to be talking, but we're going to focus on Ben for sure to get things started.
Sounds good.
Okay. Does that work for you, Ben?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's hear a little bit of your humble beginnings. Tell me where and how you grew up. What was your family life like? Did you go to church? Yeah. Did you have friends? Did your friends like you? How did that all work out?
Yeah, I was kind of, I grew up as a missionary's kid and as a pastor's kid. My dad had gone to a seminary in St. Louis. And so we went out into ministry as a family. And my brother and I were born during my dad's early beginnings there. We ended up in Sri Lanka for a season, which is a little teardrop-shaped island off the southeast coast of India. And we were there for about a year and a half, and then I did most of my growing up in New York City, where my dad eventually became a pastor. So
in New York City?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's a pretty easy place to grow up, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of can be counted as a rough neighborhood. Some people feel like it's growing up in Gotham City or something.
George, did I just sound a little sarcastic there?
No, Bill. Probably pretty accurate. I would think that would be quite the shock after Sri Lanka.
Yeah. Yeah.
New York City. Yeah. There's parts of New York City that feel like a third world country, you know, mm-hmm. So it's just when I was growing up there. And so I hear that's still the case today sometimes. So,
okay. So if dad was a missionary, you must have been plugged into a church community and a family life and all that.
Yeah. Yeah. We were. I grew up in a solid Christian house in many respects. And so my dad was a head pastor, associate pastor first at the church that we were at for a real long stretch.
Yeah.
And but then he became the head pastor, and so that's where I did most of my growing up in that church, and still would have great connections with a lot of those same people who watched me grow up and knew me as a child. And so, yeah.
And this story has no rebellion in it, does it?
Unfortunately, it eventually did.
I didn't see this coming, George. Did you?
No, it's a good start.
It's a great start. Yeah. So, all right. So all of a sudden, are you in high school now when the rebellion starts to kick in a little?
Yeah. As a kid, really none of this showed up early on for me. I mean, there were some things that I experienced as a kid that kind of set me up. I later learned for the episode that wound up becoming my life in my teenage years. But no, my childhood was pretty stable for the most part. Mm-hmm. You know, it really kind of started about age 17 for me. I had just come home for an overseas missions trip during the summer, and there was already some early signs of some real problems that were showing up in my house, some rebellion that was happening in my siblings. And so I just went headlong into all of this, and in a very, very short time, I was in a lot of trouble.
So was it you weren't coping with the household situation, or you were?
Yeah. A lot of it is just, you know, you think of it as almost unpaid bills, you know, emotional debt that you incur from early childhood experiences. I was really picked on a lot as a kid. There was some physical abuse that I encountered early on. There was even a family member who was involved in it. So it just really set me up in a lot of respects for what would later become this 5-year odyssey of craziness.
Mm-hmm. So interesting way to frame it. 5-year odyssey of craziness. George, that's a first in 12 years.
I'm really interested to hear about the odyssey.
Yeah. I mean, you've got a 38-year odyssey, but I don't want to go there because it's, you know, Ben's our guest tonight.
Well, that's actually, in recovery, and you're right. Every day is a new adventure over here.
All right. So, Ben, you set yourself up with a great teaser. What does a 5-year odyssey look like? Tell me what happened.
Well, it all started. My brother and I decided that we would start to use together. And so that led to other things. We started out with more of a gateway chemical drug that wound up spinning into some other problems. Within a very short time, I would say a period less than 6 months, we were getting either high or drunk most nights a week with a group of friends that we were connected to. And so we went all over New York City getting in all kinds of trouble. And so unfortunately, my head, if I just stop and think about it, is filled with all sorts of memories of just a really crazy life that I began to live and embrace at that point. So out till all hours of the night, you know, just keg parties in different parts of New York City. And it really just began to wear at me, destroy my life, and later went on to destroy my health. I also became during those days, a three-pack-a-day cigarette smoker. So that was a very expensive habit in addition to everything else that was going on, and was just part of the scene, the party scene that I was a part of at that time. You know, the New York City clubs and all of that lifestyle. You know, I mean, I have memories of doing some pretty crazy things. And so, yeah.
Were you and your brother, did you guys start using together because you wanted to numb out, or were you seeking pleasure, or a combination of both?
Well, as I look back at it in retrospect, because 2020 is our hindsight is 2020, you tend to see very clearly after things are long over. At the time, even as I began to come out of drugs and alcohol, I don't think I fully understood all the reasons that I had gotten in the first place. So what I would say now is that it probably had to do with a lot of the pain that happened in my early life and the abuse that I suffered. Physically, mentally, emotionally, and that was really the predicate to all this. It was the thing that opened the door from an emotional standpoint, because when you have those type of wounds in your life, if you don't ever get the chance to really sit down and deal with it, and this is deeper than just forgiveness, it's learning to actually cope with what tends to happen to you in emotional circumstances and relational circumstances going forward. How do you cope with that stuff? So growing up this way and having this collection of experiences really was the thing for me that was the background for why I started using.
Mm-hmm. Was there a time when your parents were looking at you going, where have you been? What have you been up to? We're not happy with you.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. My dad is a pastor. I mean, I put my parents through a tremendous amount of grief.
Sure. Yeah.
So being in New York City, you know, always trying to get away with things, try to sneak around behind dad's back. You know, I have memories of, you know, trying to get away with things and being out in remote spots in a park somewhere in New York City, and would get home that night and lo and behold, dad had followed us in his car out to that particular park and was watching us from the parking lot out of his vehicle, just taking it all in. And then as soon as we got home, having done what we had been doing, he would confront us. And a lot of these confrontations, I wish that I had responded in better ways to them. Unfortunately, you know, my brother was probably not as skillful as a liar as I was in those days. And so I ended up getting away with a lot of that stuff somehow. My brother bore a lot of the brunt of that. And, but yeah, he really did. My mom and dad really did try to reach out to us and to be available to us in those times. But I think that the addiction had really started to take over. The emotional trauma from the past played a huge part in all of that. And so that really galvanized me. And that was why my addiction was long lasting.
Did you know what you needed back then? Or is that a really dumb question?
Oh, I wish I did. Yeah. I wish I had known. I really had very little self-awareness.
Okay.
I was driven in my interest towards a couple of different things, in addition to drugs and alcohol. And all of these things just kind of dominated my thinking on a daily basis. And so I had passions around becoming a professional musician and really spent a lot of time working hard at that. And then when I wasn't working hard on those sorts of things, I was going out partying. So.
Mm-hmm. George, I don't know if you've got a question. I got a couple more, but jump in.
If growing up in that environment, going, you know, on missionary trips and missions, did you feel like you kind of got ripped off and you missed out on some stuff?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. If I could somehow wave a magic wand and erase all this stuff, yes, there was tons that I missed out on. Anyone that is in addiction will tell you that, you know, for any one person who falls off and delves into a lifestyle of addiction, there's going to be 500 people minimally that are going to become impacted. Well, I was a pastor's kid, so that widens it a little bit more automatically right there. And so the concentric circles just get worse. It reverberates in some big ways. And you wind up really wrestling with some arrested development issues. You just don't grow the way you ought to when you are masking all of your emotional struggles and trauma using coping mechanisms like you know, chemical substances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very wise point. George, I know that you would probably have something to say about that as well. When you are in those developmental years and you're largely using all the time, you're not, your frontal lobe, your frontal cortex is not developing in a proper way, is it?
Well, I really what I meant by the question was an interesting answer. I was wondering if in your childhood, when you're moving around, probably tough to make friends, and you and your brother decided one night to go out, I thought maybe you felt ripped off because you missed out on a lot of fun.
Yeah. You know, I didn't so much feel that way. My brother really felt that way. I was under no illusions. I understood that walking a life with God had its moments of fun. And I was able to recognize that because our church environment really wasn't the type of church environment where, you know, you're expecting to go in and have a miserable time. A lot of churches, you know, even to this day, sometimes they'll have cry rooms because they expect children to have a really bad time when they go to church. But my church experience wasn't like that growing up. I saw people having fun. I would see, you know, my dad and as well as pastors that he was connected with running around having water balloon fights with the kids. So there was lots of opportunities for me to recognize that my faith community was a really dynamic place. But my brother really, I think he probably was the one that felt like he was missing out on something. He began to identify more and more with the people that were around us and sort of community and school and things like that. And of course, My brother had an impact on me. I think we impacted each other.
Is your brother older or younger?
He's a younger brother. He's a year and a half younger than I, but okay. We were super close because, you know, as an MK, you go over to, you know, a foreign country and you can't speak the language, so you bond as a family more.
Of course, yeah.
And it can be an isolating thing if you're going around to different churches, which we did. Your community gets disrupted a bit, and that can also be challenging for all sorts of reasons. So,
well, it's a fascinating start to the story, Ben. And I'm thinking that between you and your brother, was there a sister involved in that too?
Yeah,
in the family.
Yeah, there was. Her times really didn't show up until later in her life. She did have some struggles, nowhere near what my brother and I had struggled with. Mm-hmm. She just never got that extreme, and we're to this day pretty happy about that.
Mm-hmm. But I can imagine between you and your brother, there was a lot of pressure on your dad just to go be a pastor at a church when he's got a couple of boys at home that are in the family that are struggling.
Yeah. I mean, there were multiple times where he just wanted to leave the ministry because he just felt like he had been a failure as a pastor to instill faith into his family and a soundness and a faith walk. And we just weren't there. And that broke his heart. There were multiple times, I think, where he had written a resignation letter that my mother refused to allow him to submit to the church. So I was aware, and actually that probably is one of the things that kept me out in the world as long as I was, is simply because I knew that I had caused him such tremendous pain.
Mm-hmm.
So,
all right, we're going to take a little break. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and what's his name? George. Yeah, we're going to take a break. Ryan's on the board. Ben is our special guest in here today with his wife, Sarah. We'll be right back. All right, Real Recovery has returned with George and Bill. How about that, George? I don't think I've ever done that before.
Recovery. It was really heartfelt.
Well, it was heartfelt, especially after the break the last time where I kind of stumbled on your name. I didn't mean to do that. Well, maybe I did.
Hey, you know, super interesting start. And I'm thinking if you're a drug addict, alcoholic, the good thing about having a dad as a pastor is you're not one of those. You're a prodigal.
Yeah, you get to call yourself a prodigal. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
There's some advantage to that, isn't there?
All right. Yeah.
Amidst all the five-year odyssey, was there anything that happened in those 5 years that involved law enforcement or loss of job or anything that is of that kind of significance?
You know, fortunately, I somehow slipped by the law a number of times, had some brushes with police, you know. I have one memory of running from the police, you know, while a weapon was being discharged. But somehow we managed to stay out of, you know, winding up being incarcerated. And in some ways, that's both a good thing and a bad thing. If I had wound up with more severe consequences, perhaps the length of all of this would have been cut short. That would have been a great thing. And God is a way of using stories like that. And I've heard many stories like that over the years. But somehow, my brother and I just managed to avoid that. And I don't think it was because we were so clever. I think God was just telling a different story with us. And he was going to take things in a direction that would wind up leading to deliverance, at least for me. So
I bet the amount of prayer that was going on your behalf was huge.
Well, my goodness, when you're a pastor and you do a prayer meeting every Friday night in church, you know.
Yeah, your kids are getting prayed for.
That's right. Your kids are going on the menu, the prayer menu. So we were being prayed for a lot, and it got pretty intense toward the end of my walk and towards, you know, my deliverance. So.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. Tell me what happened when you had that moment of clarity. George, what do we call it when you have this moment where you're desperate or you come to clarity with where you're at and what you need to start doing?
Well, it's a moment of mental clarity where you're beaten into a state of reasonableness.
Yeah, that's such a good way to say it. you know, the suffering. My wife's here sitting right next to me is with a huge smile on her face. She knows exactly what happened at this point. So I was jumping around to different colleges during that season of my life. And I wound up in a college. It was called Evangel University. It was in Springfield, Missouri, a great Christian college. And during that season, this particular season, there was a traveling evangelist that was coming through this college campus. And so it was kind of a prolonged season. He was preaching at this campus, this college campus, night after night after night. And it led to a series of revival meetings that stretched, it felt like, several months, if my memory serves me correct. And what was so amazing about this particular season of my life is that God had coincidentally brought me into a time of intense suffering because of the bad choices that I was making. I had been sleeping during those days on a mattress that had a scabies infestation on it. And so for the listener, if you don't know the craziness of something like this, it's you wind up with all these insects that are crawling all over your body all the time. And so I was, trying to find ways to, create more trouble for myself. At the same time, this was happening, and I was showering multiple times a day. And then this led to an eczema rash that just broke out of my body from head to toe. And so there was really literally no position I could lay in where I could find physical comfort for myself. There was really no way to soothe myself. In the course of about 1 month, I maybe slept about 24 hours, I think. If I slept more than that, I would be surprised. So I was deeply, deeply sleep deprived at this point. I was probably pretty imbalanced in my body in all sorts of ways. And this happened to be a season in my life when I'm at this Christian college and there's this traveling evangelist coming through, preaching nightly meetings. And what does a guy do who's in a situation like this? Well, he shows up at the chapel. He's curious about what's going on. And so that's what happened to me. And so I showed up at these chapel services, and the only way I can describe it is it just felt, Bill, like the presence of God just came and camped out in that sanctuary. Whenever this man took the platform, no one moved. You could just hear a pin drop in the place. Mm. And he had this crazy banner stretched out in front of the stage that said, "Saving a Generation." And that was what he felt his call was. And so he's preaching this message of real repentance, true conversion, give your life to Jesus, don't look back. And all of these people, I mean, there must have been several thousand in attendance every single time the chapel was open. And so hundreds would go forward for these altar calls. And I'm standing there watching all this happen, and I knew that God was knocking on the door of my heart. And to my own shame, I never actually wound up responding to one of those altar calls. But I did have my own personal altar call moment in a grassy commons area of that college campus. And it was a fall night. I still remember it. It's a very vivid memory for me. And I stepped out onto this grassy commons area. It was like 11 o'clock at night, and the revival meetings had just ended and people were getting prayer and I wasn't up there getting prayer.
Did you still have scabies at this point?
I was still pretty suffering pretty intensely.
You're uncomfortable.
Oh, yeah.
Yep.
But I felt like Job. You know, I felt like there was no way that I could find physical comfort and that really this had all been orchestrated by God. And I knew he was calling me back to himself. And the only thing that I could say about this, it was the weirdest experience. It all of a sudden just felt like I wasn't alone on that field. And the presence of God is a spiritual thing, but it felt way more than just spiritual. It almost bordered for me. It felt like almost like a physical experience, like being walked around back and forth mm-hmm. in an open field with a person standing next to you. And so the Lord was talking to me and calling me back to himself. And, you know, I was still trying to resist it, but I knew that this was a moment, if I didn't take this, it was all going to get much, much worse from mm-hmm. here.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be my life if I didn't submit, if I didn't agree. And so I knew that this all started out with confession of sin. And so I began to confess my sin and to the Lord. And I suddenly had the sense that I had to go call my father. And that was a really hard thing to do because I had brought such shame to my family. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to face that. But for some reason, that just really loomed large in my mind. If I do this, this is a good first step for me to take. And so I went back home to my dorm and I went back to my room, my dorm room, and I picked up the phone and started talking to my father, who had just, several days earlier gotten out of a prayer meeting, which had been crying out for me. And I said, "Dad, I have a story to tell you, and I want to let you know that I am coming back to the Lord." And I was in tears. It was just a really sweet moment for me, but there was a lot of pain that I was carrying because I needed forgiveness. And so I started confessing, and my dad just sat there and listened for a couple minutes. And then about 5 or 10 minutes into it, he just said to me, "Son, I just want to stop you for a second because I know that you feel you have to rehearse this all to me right now and just tell me everything that you ever did. But I just want to tell you, you don't need to go through all this because I want you to know that I forgive you." And I was totally blown away by that. That my dad would be willing to forgive me was a big, big deal. And God did a miracle that night. I don't have the same story that a lot of people do who come through the sort of situation I did. Most people have to go through some sort of chemical dependency program, and I never did. And as I've searched for reasons from the Bible as to why this happened to me, it was years later I felt like I found what maybe might have been the answer. And so for me, it really helped to confirm some things, to understand really the power of the gospel and Jesus' ability to deliver people from really, really extreme circumstances like mine. So Paul says in Romans 6:14, sin won't have dominion over you. And to a lot of people who maybe hear that verse for the first time, it almost sounds like fantasy because lots of Christian people struggle with the power of sin. They wonder how to get free. They don't understand why they are still, after years of following Christ, they're just dragged back into their sin almost against their will in spite of themselves. How does that happen? And then Paul has the nerve to come along and say that sin won't have dominion or mastery over you. That just sounds crazy when you first hear a statement like that. But then Paul goes on in the second half of that verse to give us the reason. He says, sin won't have dominion over you since you're not under law, but under grace. And there's something about the power of forgiveness that really tremendously affects the heart. And I began to really appreciate several things as I thought about my story years later. I thought about the very few people that I'd ever met that had a story like mine. Maybe 4 or 5 folks that just miraculously got free like that. And really what it is that Paul's showing us, the Bible showing us there, that sin is not just simply an evil deed that someone does. It's a supernatural power that controls you. But just like electricity, there needs to be certain conditions present in order for it to do this. And so for me, as I thought about what that verse was saying, I recognized, I see it. Grace disrupts the power of sin. And when it's properly appreciated and it's received, then it can actually cause sin's power to lose control over the course of someone's life. But see, the catch-22 to that is that, do you really believe that that's true? Do you believe that God has forgiven you? Any area of my life where I struggle to receive God's grace, that's an area where I'm going to struggle in sin. But any area of my life where I learn to take God's grace for granted, I'm going to walk in effortless holiness. Now, that happened to me in the area of my chemical addictions, but it sure didn't happen in a lot of other areas of my life where I had no way to forgive myself. And so from that point on, it really was a long walk of trying to learn how to apply God's grace.
Amazing. Ben is our guest tonight. George, I know you've got some thoughts on Ben's recovery. He's got 25 years of sobriety, which is awesome. But I know you got a question.
You know, you're clairvoyant there, Bill, and another one of your gifts. I
don't talk about that gift very often.
Yeah, well, you know, we all know it. And how come God took away your chemical dependency and not other areas?
Yeah, and I would say that Jesus ideally wants to take away every sin. He doesn't just want, the cross doesn't just deal with the penalty of sin. It deals with the problem of sin. The problem is we don't believe it. We struggle to believe that we're forgiven. You know, I wish it were the case that every single time I ever heard Jesus whisper to my heart, "I forgive you, son," that I simply took it for granted and learned to stop rubbernecking over all of my sinful encounters that I've ever had in my life where I've incurred guilt. But the truth is that sometimes, well, a lot of times, the cross is just not as distracting as it needs to be to get us to stop looking at that guilt. And so we continue. And that's why we need the body of Christ. We need people to come along that are outside of us to remind us, hey, you know, you really are forgiven. I needed 100 people like my dad on my team to say to me, "I know you want to rehearse every little detail, but I want to tell you that God forgives you, and so do I." And the truth of the matter is that, you know, each one of us, we need a community like that. We're never going to make it. If it's just me somehow trying to wrestle with the Bible, I'm going to fail every single time. But if I can just open up that book and meet with the Lord over those pages with someone else across the table from me, that is going to make all the difference in my winding up being transformed by the living Christ.
That's awesome, Ben.
You have guilt.
Say that again, George. Start your sentence over.
You sin because you still have guilt. I sin because I want to.
Okay? Yeah, and, there's also that.
You know, like, I don't think there's any sin I commit that I didn't choose to do it because I thought my way would be better than God's.
Yeah.
And so for me, I guess I don't. The guilt thing for me, and I think for a lot of us, guilt is good because it lets me know my beliefs. I have violated my moral beliefs by my thoughts, words, or actions, right?
Yeah.
And so I just thought that that's really an interesting approach. So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, it's true. I agree with what he just said, what George just said. I wish you were in the room right now because you could see me grinning over here. Yeah, I absolutely identify with this. And I think that those times where we do deliberately choose that we're just going to go do this sinful thing, you know, it's because we want it. But the truth of the matter is that if, you know, if all that was needed to get free of sin was just to say sorry to God and agree with our moral consciences, Jesus probably wouldn't have to come and die for that. The issue is that sin is a controlling power that operates in us even against our will. I wish that weren't true. And that was really, that's why people struggle with all these life controlling issues. And that was why I struggled so much. But God was merciful and he still is today. And Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever.
Amen to that. We're taking a little break. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. Our guest Ben and Sarah are here with us. We're going to be right back. We are back. This is Real Recovery with Bill and George. If you play this show with George and I in your carpool, you're guaranteed to annoy someone in your carpool, just so you know. We got a great guest, though. Ben is here, and we want to talk out, Ben, how you're walking out your recovery. 25 years of sobriety, that is no small task. And tell us how you work that out every day.
Yeah, well, for me, the community aspect of it is utterly important. If we don't have people in our corner, if we're not able to talk about the problems that we're struggling with, if we never bring these things into deliberation with others, then we're going to wind up staying stuck. One of the folks that Sarah and I have come to listen to is Jimmy and Renee Rollins, pastor of church in, I believe, Texas, or is it?
They did.
They, okay, yeah. And
welcome, Sarah, by the way.
Yeah, she just came my wife. Yeah, she's just stepping out to the mic. And so one of the things that she said is Renee Rollins, is that you're only as sick as your secrets. And so we have to have community where we can bring this stuff into the light and talk about the problems that we're facing. And I found that I don't have that kind of a relational connection. I can gradually begin to slip backwards, and you feel it. The gravitational pull of the world and of your old life is real. And so this is why that community aspect is so important.
Yeah, I would say we've been married for 15 years.
Yeah.
And when Ben first started to pursue me, I had had some significant relationships in my life that there was addiction involved and relatives and some other situations. And so I saw the importance of, first of all, admitting if it's an issue, and then secondly, facing it head on. And so I remember when we started dating, I said, are you willing to say no alcohol at all? And he said, yes. My family has ministered to people that have addiction in their background, and I saw the results of that. And out of that, I had a passion to stay away from it. And thankfully, he said no. And as a result, a lot of what we're currently doing is working with people that struggle in addiction. And I also knew in my own life, it's easy to numb the pain. It's easy to seek things to distract. And I knew that if you choose alcohol or drugs, the results of that can be more severe. And so we started on our marriage and relationship saying no to that.
So if you had 25 years sobriety right now, Ben, and you guys have been married 15 years, so when you met Sarah, you were sober.
I was sober for about 9 years, yeah. Pretty close to 10.
So what she was asking for from you was continued sobriety, because she did not suspect that you had a problem because you were sober.
Yeah, so when we were in a getting to know each other type of phase of dating, there was a lot that we would need to wind up discussing. And so just at the beginning of our relationship, there were some expectations that we talked about right away, and that was one of hers, that she wanted to be married to somebody who would have a dry house. And I said, well, yeah, actually, that would be good for me too, because I also had some struggles in that area in my life, and I shared with her my story of recovery at that point. And so as everything became known, it just became clear to us, well, this is the way that we're going to live. We're going to endeavor to follow the Lord. And it's been a radical commitment on our part and in some respects, but it's been a good one. It's been one that has helped us to sustain us.
Wasn't that a huge sigh of relief when Sarah said, I want us to have a dry house?
Oh, yeah.
Weren't you like, thank you, Lord? That's not only what I want, but it's what I need.
It's what I need. And she really was. God delivered to me a spouse that has been able to walk with me every step of the way in my life ever since then, and in the endeavors that, that God has led us to do as a family. It's all been supported by those internal secret commitments that you make to follow the Lord and to live with Him. And so, having a spouse that walks with you through all of that is just absolutely integral. So,
mm-hmm. And Sarah, how do you help Ben?
Well, first of all, addiction can come in many forms. And so we look at everything, whether that's our phone, we look at our computers, we just keep in constant communication, not because we have to, but because we want to.
Nice.
The two of us are in ministry, and so we also know as leaders, you're called to a higher standard. And with that, there's a lot of ways, even if you are making the right decisions, someone can accuse you that you're not. And so part of our safety is to keep that accountability, and we enjoy it. It's nice to not have any secrets. It's nice to ask those hard questions. Sometimes maybe I don't like the answer, but we found it's far better to bring it into the light. Maybe if it's a small thing, than it is to all of a sudden find that there's been a different world that the other person has created, or a secret that they've been hiding for a long time. And I'd say I'm stronger in the emotional intelligence. And so I'll look at him and say, let's dig deeper. And that's helped him face some things of his past, whether that's going to counseling, having our mentors really tell us, hey, maybe you guys are not having a healthy response to each other, or maybe go to a conference. And so we've had a lot of people that have helped us redefine health, redefine interaction, redefine just how we think about things. And so we've continued to seek those things. So our community is huge, and he has his own mentors. I have my own mentors that have asked us those hard questions that have helped us from turning to self-soothing, other things that are tempting, but yet they're not really getting to the core of maybe a struggle.
Mm-hmm. George, I'm going to defer to you with a couple minutes left.
Well, it sounds real solid, and you both sound like you work your own program apart from each other so you can come and work on your relationship together. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it really is. It really is, for sure. And, you know, it just, a lot of the stuff that God has for us in our future, you know, you don't see it initially when you first come back to Christ, but there's just no way that you can carry out the plans God has for you if you're not walking in a place where you're gradually working on your recovery at some level. And so now at this point, I mean, I'm working with Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge. I'm one of their profs over at their Bible college, and a lot of people getting trained up for ministry there. And then I'm doing church planting right now. My wife and I are planting a church in our city, Anoka, Minnesota. And it's just been, for us, there's just no way to really walk out God's plans if you're going to entertain unwillingness to work together on the issues, and to, you know, weekly even just bring these things into the light so that you can grow through it all.
Mm-hmm. We just have a couple of minutes left, Ben. I'm curious, how's your brother doing?
Yeah. Well, so our family, we continue to pray for him, and there does seem to be some lights that are going on in his heart, you know, with respect to understanding who Jesus is, you know.
Well, so, the minute you brought him up and that you guys started partying together, I instantly started caring about him as well.
Yeah,
and thought, oh, this sweet man, how is he today? And I was hoping that there's a story as victorious as yours, but we'll keep praying for him.
Yeah. And if Colin were listening, you know, to this, I would say, hey, brother, the water's good, man. Jump in.
So. we'll have to figure out a way to get this message to Colin so he can hear it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, and your situation with your folks all ended up patching up nicely?
It did, yeah. Yeah, and that grace that I encountered in that initial phone call has continued to remain part of my relationship with my parents right up into the present.
That's a beautiful moment. Ben, thank you. Sarah, thank you so much. It's been great having you tell your amazing story.
Yeah,
thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right, George, that kind of wraps up another award-winning episode of Real Recovery. Any parting thoughts?
Yeah, just thanks for showing up and sharing your story with us. It's just fantastic.
Yeah, and thank you for listening to Real Recovery tonight, and thank you for supporting Faith Radio. Have a great week, everyone. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.